Welcome to the JNNP Podcast, a series where we discuss cutting-edge research published by the BMJ's Journal of Neurology, Neurosurgery, and Psychiatry. I'm Saima Chaudhry. I'm an autoimmune and general neurologist, and I am based in Rhode Island, so I'm in the USA. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Alexander Rosser, a neuromuscular specialist practicing in the UK, about his article entitled Nutritional Peripheral Neuropathies. Before we get into our conversation, just a reminder that you can subscribe to our podcast on your preferred platform, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Well, it's really nice to meet you today, Alex. So tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a neurologist in London, in the UK. And my specialist interest is peripheral neuropathy. But I also do general neurology in two hospitals in London, one at Queen's Square, where I do the neuropathy, and I do general neurology at Guy's and St. Thomas's, opposite Houses of Parliament. And with my peripheral neuropathy, I'd started off doing a lot of interest in sort of genetic neuropathies. And then with the passage of time, with populations we've got here, started to develop a bit of an interest in sort of nutritional neuropathy, having seen it a lot, both in the sort of general neurology practice, but also in peripheral nerve practice. And then sort of things have moved on from there. And so I got a PhD student working with me, and we thought, you know, it was an important topic that had sort of been neglected for a while. It was sort of worth bringing it back into the neurology vernacular.
Yeah, I love that. And that's why I thought this article was pretty, it was a really great breakdown. It was very thorough. And so we're here today talked about your article, Nutritional Peripheral Neuropathies. And so like you said, it's a very important topic. I guess, why do you think it's important for the general neurologist, someone like me?
Well, I think, first of all, it's common. So, you know, nutritional neuropathies are common. And I think peripheral neuropathy seems to, well, when you've got a nutritional deficiency, it seems to be the peripheral nerves and probably the optic nerves as well are particularly susceptible. So it's, you know, it is important for general neurologists because it's a common manifestation of a common problem. And I suppose the other reason why I think it's important is It requires a lot of old-fashioned neurology skills. So trying to prove a nutritional deficiency sometimes, you know, it comes down sometimes to your history and your examination and the whole clinical picture. There's not one expensive genetic test you can send off. The MRI scan's normal. So it's old-fashioned neurology, and it's something we all see in clinical practice.
Yeah, I totally agree. I get a lot of consults for peripheral neuropathy in my practice, actually. So it's something that I see a lot, and I agree with you. It's not something where you can just order an image, like an MRI, and have your answer. So it does require those quote-unquote old-school skills. You have to actually physically examine your patient to determine that, one, they have a peripheral neuropathy. And then, you know, based on your expertise, what are some common causes of peripheral neuropathy that you've seen just in general?
So peripheral neuropathy in general, I suppose, in the general practice, it's diabetes and chemotherapy and neuropathy are probably the two big ones. And then I think outside of that, when it sort of idiopathic neuropathies, I think there's a reasonable number, vitamin B12. Often, I used to underdiagnose it, I realized, because I used to just send off a total B12. And that always came back normal. And so I always thought B12 neuropathy was pretty rare. And only sort of more recently, when I started to be a bit more nuanced about it, realized it's actually very common. And in terms of other common causes, I think probably a lot of the idiopathic ones, some of them probably genetic. I still see, you know, quite a few genetic, although there is a bit of a referral bias there. And CIDP, much, much rarer than the rest.
Yes, yeah. I don't see CIDP a whole lot, but I do have a couple patients with that, and that is my worst fear because I'm not a neuromuscular specialist. So then when you make that diagnosis, it obviously it's a chronic condition that can really affect patients. So not the best thing to have someone walk into your office and then end up having that. You know, I guess you would prefer peripheral neuropathy instead of someone with a chronic neuromuscular condition. But tell me a little bit about you know, the nutritional causes of peripheral neuropathy, because your article is very extensive. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think so. I think the main thing about the nutritional deficiencies and neuropathy is a big central group, the B vitamins, and that's what we sort of concentrated on in the article. Although it's probably worth saying there are some other, you know, nutritional causes that we haven't covered so much. So some of the fat-soluble vitamins, so vitamin E, which I have to say I don't think I've ever actually seen. I think that's partly because I think at-risk groups like cystic fibrosis, people with sort of pancreatic insufficiency, often reasonably well supplemented. And there's some metals like copper deficiency, which we haven't talked about. But sort of coming back to these, so the main ones we've talked about in the article, I think, are the commonest ones are the B vitamins. Obviously, the vitamin B12, probably by far and away the commonest. The one that sort of comes with B12, which is a bit of a grey area, is the sort of folic acid, which is, it's common, you know, and especially when you measure your red cell. Sorry, you know, we measure plasma folate as opposed to red cell folate. Now, the thing about plasma folate is it generally reflects your folic acid intake for your last meal or your recent intake rather than your total body stores. So you end up with, a lot of the time we do a clinic early in the morning, people have had a breakfast, and we get these very, very low folic acid levels. So that's a slight problem. And then the question is whether it causes peripheral neuropathy. And we've tried to talk a bit about that in the article. I think it's fair to say it's, in most people, it doesn't. I think if you've B12 deficient in the past and you're folate deficient, it can contribute to the neuropathy. And I have seen people with this, you get these thermostable polymorphisms in the gene MTHFR. They're often tested for, they're very common, about 50% of the population. And I've seen people with who have two mutations in this and they're folate deficient who have got a neuropathy. Other than B12 and folate, the other ones we see vitamin B6. So pyridoxine, particularly in alcoholics, I think, is, you know, that's where I've really seen it. And thiamine. But I think thiamine is a slightly more tricky one because it's very difficult to test for it. And even in my experience, when you've seen patients with it who've got good going Wernicke's or something like that, it's often normal, the test.
Yeah, you know, I've noticed that in my practice too. You know, I commonly test for B12 and folic acid, and the folic acid always confuses me because, like you said, it seems like it's affected by diet a little bit more. So tell me a little bit more about that. Like, how can we rely on this level then? And then what do you do in your clinical practice when you're ordering, you know, folic acid levels?
I mean, I always measure B12 and folate together, and obviously it's very important to do that, especially if somebody's vegetarian or vegan. That's a big clue to measure it. So one hospital I work at, we just measure the total B12, and if you're measuring the total B12, I would send a homocysteine and a methylmalonic acid as well, you know, the downstream metabolites. And if you've got a B12 is sort of below, rough 50% of below the middle value, you really need to test it. And if you've got to raise methylmalonic acid or a homocysteine, then you may have a functional B12 deficiency. But coming back to the folic acid, I mean, you can get folic acid that's very low, but if it's a folate that's significant, then you'll have a normal B12 and your homocysteine will be up. But even if you've got a raised homocysteine, your folic acid is low. In the vast majority of cases, it's still not going to be relevant to your peripheral neuropathy. So I think the jury's still out. There's epidemiological data looking at primary care records and showing that there's an inverse relationship between folic acid and peripheral neuropathy. So the lower your folic acid, the more likely you are to have a peripheral neuropathy. And then I suppose the thing that probably links it the most is that, you know, there are people with inborn errors of folate metabolism, people with mutations in methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. So, you know, that gene that's involved in homocysteine metabolism. And if you have recessive mutations in that loss of function, you get a multisystem disease with peripheral neuropathy. So I mean, I think that's the sort of, that's the really hard human genetic evidence that folic acid is involved in peripheral nerve maintenance. And I think it probably can, but in the vast majority of cases, the low folic acid probably isn't the cause of your neuropathy, even if the homocysteine is up a little bit.
So from what I understand, when you are working up a patient with peripheral neuropathy, you obtain, you know, standard studies such as an A1C, B12, folic acid, and then it seems like you also obtain serum lab values of methylmalonic acid and homocysteine. Can you just kind of explain how methylmalonic acid and homocysteine are related to B12 and folic acid deficiencies?
Yeah, of course. I mean, B12 is required. Well, it's a cobalt containing molecule. It's required for an enzyme, adenosyl cobalamin, and that enzyme is required for the conversion of methylmalonic acid to succinyl coenzyme A. So we don't have enough B12, the methylmalonic acid accumulates because it can't get broken down quickly enough. So that's why you get the high methylmalonic acid. And then it's the same for the homocysteine pathway. Homocysteine is broken down, I think, to methionine. And that is dependent upon, well, a cycle requiring enzymes that require folic acid and also B12, but as part of something called methylcobalamin. So again, in that scenario, you get a low folate or a low B12. The homocysteine doesn't get broken down and it accumulates. But what is quite interesting is, you know, the question is which one you measure, the methylmalonic acid or the homocysteine. And in one hospital I work at, they tend to measure the methylmalonic acid automatically. But one interesting with the B12, it's sort of an, I don't know if it's the same in the US, whether you're having this almost outbreak of nitrous oxide use as a recreational drug. You know, and it's become a bit of a problem over here because they've, it used to be small, tiny little canisters that you get, you know, like the ones you get to, you know, pump up your bike tire. And but then they've changed them now to sort of huge, liter-sized. So we're getting a lot of it. But essentially what that does, the nitrous oxide, is it binds to the cobalt ions of methylcobalamin and not adenosylcobalamin. So actually with nitrous oxide, when you get the neuropathy from that, the methylmalonic acid might actually be normal. So you might have a normal B12 and a normal methylmalonic acid, and it's actually the homocysteine that goes sky high. So if you think someone's got nitrous oxide functional B12 deficiency and you just measure the methylmalonic acid, you may be reassured when in fact it should be the homocysteine that you should be measuring.
Yeah, I heard about the nitrous oxide issue in the UK. We certainly see that in the US. We actually did a prior podcast about it, so it's great that you kind of brought that up again. Tell me a little bit about the populations at risk for these kind of deficiencies, because you mentioned people that were vegetarian and vegan, but when you're taking your clinical history, what other things should raise a red flag for you that the patient tells you that could make them at risk?
The big things are obviously people's diets. We talked about vegetarian and veganism. The other major one, I think, is alcohol use. So, I mean, alcoholism is a huge risk factor, not just from the direct effects of alcohol, but if you've got somebody with, you know, high alcohol consumption, then it is a big risk factor for thiamine and B6 deficiency. The other one we see now quite a bit is post-bariatric surgery. Some people just can't take the supplements. You know, afterwards, they get such terrible abdominal tightness that they are, you know, they're vomiting, they can't keep down the supplements. And the thing that tends to present first in those patients, in my experience, is thiamine deficiency, because the body stores are the lowest. And so even after a bariatric surgery, you can get people presenting with thiamine deficiency and neuropathy or central signs really after about 4 or 5 weeks. So that, I mean, that is a big risk factor. I've also seen somebody after post-bariatric surgery who was put on zinc replacement, and then they went on and got copper deficiency because the zinc, you know, competes with copper. So it was the treatment for that. And then the other group that we see it in, it was more tricky sometimes. are people with really restrictive, you know, self-imposed restrictive diets. I mean, it can be anybody, particularly people with sometimes with autistic spectrum disorder who may have, you know, very particular food preferences and will have a completely normal body mass index, no alcohol, and it can be quite tricky. And you're not, and sometimes not even kind of a normal body mass index, may even be overweight. And it can be more difficult to pick that up.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you talked about certain populations like, you know, even autism spectrum disorder and how they can get peripheral neuropathies based on diet. And my brother actually has severe autism spectrum disorder, and he is very picky with his diet. And I never thought about that before. So I thought that was fabulous that your article mentioned it, because I had not seen that reported in other places before. And it's interesting that you also mention the zinc issue, because at least in the States, when the COVID-19 pandemic came out, all news stations were like, take zinc. And so as a neurologist, you're just sitting there kind of holding your head saying, oh God, this is going to be bad. And then, you know, a couple years out, I had so many people in my office and we were talking about the histories and, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic, and somehow it came up and asked them, are you taking any supplements? They immediately say no. But then, you know, somehow as you're about to leave the room, they're like, oh, by the way, I have been doing zinc for about 2 years now, every single day. And then you're like, oh God, what if you have a copper deficiency that's leading to your sensory symptoms? So how do you commonly test for these deficiencies? Like, if someone walks into your office, are you always testing for zinc and copper, or do you base it on the clinical history? Because mind you, they may not tell you this stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good point. I am. So most, you know, if somebody, as we talked about, most people with a neuropathy, I'd send off the B12 and folate. But then when do you start doing the slightly more, you know, when do you start sending off things like tests for thiamine and B6, if alcoholics, I would send off. I do send off the B1 and the B6. So with B1, it depends where you are and how you test for it. You can test whole blood thiamine. It's not particularly helpful. The tests we do are this thiamine pyrophosphate. But again, a lot of these tests, they haven't really been validated in big populations, and you know, the levels you measure in the plasma, how well they correlate with with levels within the CNS, and I'm not sure it's been particularly established. And I know for thiamine, I do test thiamine pyrophosphate. I do test for it, but I've had patients with full blown Wernicke's and a terrible motor neuropathy, and the level when it's finally come back, having treated, is normal. So I'm really not sure how helpful that is. But the vitamin B6, you can measure it, and it's got different metabolites, but the active form is something called pyridoxine 5-phosphate. Now, that is normally what most labs will measure. I have to say that has, in my experience, correlated with phenotypes much better, and it's always been in alcoholics. But I've always sent those in patients, alcoholics or post-bariatric surgery. These are the groups I'd send that in. And then the other group, and it's something in that we talk about a bit in the article, but in the UK, and particularly in around Southeast London, is we do find within, and it can be first, second or third generation people from African Caribbean ancestry. So obviously in the UK, we had big Windrush, the boat that came over, and big populations from particularly Jamaica. And if I had somebody who's of Jamaican ancestry, even if they're second or third generation, presenting with a painful sensory neuropathy, then that for me is a big clue for it being nutritional, particularly if there's any suggestion that there is eye involvement. And I'd send off, you know, the full panel there, but particularly a homocysteine. And we started to actually measure, and this isn't part of the routine panel, but in that group, sending off an acyl-carnitine profile as a biomarker of riboflavin deficiency. But that's something we do, it's not necessarily established.
Yeah, I thought one of the most interesting thing about your article is that you had mentioned different types of neuropathies in populations that I really didn't think about, you know, as a general neurologist, right? So you mentioned endemic neuropathies. You specifically mentioned Jamaican neuritis neuropathy, neuropathy in prisoners of war, Cuban endemic neuropathy, Tanzanian endemic optic neuropathy, and spons. I'm not as familiar with these conditions, so I actually think this is quite interesting. So I was wondering if you can tell me, you know, what is Jamaican neuritis neuropathy? What is that?
Well, those examples we gave there, if you go back, they're probably all the same condition described in different populations. So, and obviously there's going to be a bit of a mixture in there. The Jamaican neuritis was the first person to describe it was a chap called, you can pronounce it two ways, Henry Strachan or Henry Strawn. And he was a Scottish physician. He went out, worked in Jamaica in the 19th century. And basically there were a lot of, you know, it was sugar plantation workers in Jamaica, very malnourished. And they would develop a really painful sensory neuropathy. They'd sometimes have visual loss, hearing loss, and they may have facial weakness. And he thought it was due to malaria, and they thought it was malaria, but basically when you gave these people sufficient nutrition, there was often some recovery. And then the other outbreaks, there was a famous one in Cuba in the early 90s. So when the USSR collapsed, and also, I think Bill Clinton imposed an embargo on Cuba. So then there was widespread food shortages. And then there was then an outbreak, again, of painful sensory neuropathy, optic neuropathy, and in some of them, hearing loss. Around the same time, again, in Tanzania, but this time mostly young men, very active, who developed the syndrome. And there were some other reports in other small studies in other predominantly African countries. And then in the UK, even going back to the 1950s, there were reports again of this called Jamaican amblyopia. So it's about a series about 200 people in the UK from Jamaica with optic neuropathy, but also sensory neuropathy and hearing loss. So it's probably the same syndrome, just being described in different countries. And the common theme is, for most of them, is dietary restriction. I mean, there are some other risk factors in there as well.
Oh, I'm getting that sense as you're kind of talking about this. I don't think I made that connection until you just mentioned it. You do outline it in your article, and it seems like it is kind of like a common syndrome that has been seen throughout history. So you're talking about optic neuropathy, sensory neural hearing loss, and almost like a painful sensory neuropathy being common features. And then the trend is that this is seen in populations that have been kind of severely malnourished. You also bring up, you know, this can happen in breastfeeding women that are very active. And that's interesting because, like I said, I'm going to be postpartum soon and I'm expecting. So, you know, I actually had seen a woman in my practice that was breastfeeding, was working very, very hard taking care of the baby and, you know, was working full time, and she had severe malnutrition. And so, you know, she kind of suffered from side effects of that. Luckily, she didn't have the painful sensory neuropathy component, but I think you bring an interesting point up to modern day neurologic practice that, you know, do we tend to see the severely malnourished, depending on where we live, we could. So that's always something to consider. But then commonly you're going to see women in your practice and, you know, if they're breastfeeding and that's something to consider for them if they're coming in with these kind of symptoms. So I'm glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, it was interesting. In Cuba, if you were breastfeeding, you got a vitamin supplement. So actually in Cuba, breastfeeding women didn't get it, but they did in Tanzania. But I think that's just because they were supplemented. You know, they were a particular part of the population that was supplemented and so didn't get the condition. I think it's partly down to one of the theories is you actively secrete riboflavin into breast milk. So as a potential, you know, and it's not been proven it's riboflavin, but that's one of the theories as to why it may have been a risk factor in some of the populations.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And then you also have mentioned B6. So B6 is one of those things. You can get a neuropathy if it's low, but then also if it's too high, you get B6 toxicity. So, you know, I don't love it in my clinical practice if people are taking just B6 alone. You know, I tell my patients, you know, don't be taking everyday zinc and don't be taking everyday B6. But tell me a little bit about B6 and what you found in your clinical practice with highs and lows of that.
The first thing to say is I think, you know, the low vitamin B6 definitely causes a neuropathy, and it probably also causes an optic neuropathy. And I think we can be pretty certain of that now. There are recently, in the last 5 years, there it's been found that recessive mutations in the enzyme that are required to convert pyridoxine to its active form. So it's pyridoxine kinase. If you get loss of function mutations in this, you get a neuropathy and you get an optic neuropathy. So, you know, I think we can be pretty confident now that vitamin B6 deficiency causes a neuropathy. And it's unusual for it to be a dietary deficiency because it's present in most foods, actually. So it's unusual for it to be a dietary deficiency, but alcohol inhibits that enzyme. So there's a direct inhibitory effect of alcohol on pyridoxine kinase. So it inhibits the conversion of pyridoxine to pyridoxine 5-phosphate, and that's why you get deficient. That's also why I think you get deficient with isoniazid, and they have to have vitamin B6 replacement. And I certainly see that. It's predominantly, you know, very common in alcoholics. And the other thing is, if you've got a low B6 level, B6 is also involved in homocysteine metabolism. So if you want a downstream biomarker, you can also, if you've got a good going B6 deficiency, your homocysteine should also be up. So that's a deficiency angle, and it's alcoholics. Now, the toxicity one, my feeling is it's been overplayed. So if you, we have the metabolic clinics, you have pyridoxine dependent disorders, and you know these patients are on high doses of pyridoxine lifelong. You know they're on 150, 200 milligrams of pyridoxine replacement, and they get away with it. And we have a drug here. Oh, it's a vitamin supplement, vitamin B Co-Strong. I don't know if you use it in the US, but it's sort of vitamin supplement, and it's basically it contains 2 milligrams of pyridoxine. So it contains 2 milligrams of pyridoxine, and your pyridoxine supplements for, you know, for isoniazid prophylaxis, you're looking at, you know, 50 to 200 milligrams. It's probably well tolerated. So the evidence, I think there is evidence that pyridoxine toxicity can cause neuropathy, but the doses they were taking were in between sort of 4,000 and 9,000 milligrams. So if you think vitamin B strong contains 2 milligrams of pyridoxine, one tablet, these people were taking 4,000 to 9,000 milligrams of pyridoxine. So we are talking about really, really high levels. And the question is, why does it cause a toxicity? And I think the most sort of compelling evidence for this is that you actually get a B6 deficiency from it. So what happens is, the pyridoxine itself is not the active form. It gets converted to pyridoxine 5-phosphate. Normally, you take a lot of supplementary pyridoxine, that enzyme can convert it all to the active form. But when you take so much, that enzyme gets saturated. And so what you do is you end up with more of the pyridoxine than the active metabolite, and then that competitively inhibits the pyridoxine 5-phosphate. So it is a deficiency. But the point is, you've got to be taking a lot. And I think sometimes there's a risk of somebody's on 100 milligrams and there's a risk of attributing a neuropathy to too much pyridoxine when it's probably not the cause.
In my clinical practice, I always am wary of kind of like the B complex that people take in tablet form. I don't know if you feel the same based on kind of what you just said, but I don't know, what are your thoughts on people taking, you know, these are normal people that just want to maintain the best health, as many patients do. And they come in and they tell you their med list and they say, well, I'm taking a daily B complex. And I'm sitting there being like, uh-oh, is this how we see the B6 toxicity? Just because we know, at least in the States, that these B complexes aren't necessarily like FDA regulated per se. So we don't actually know the dose of each vitamin that's in there. So you could be getting lower dosages than you need, or higher dosages like you're suggesting. So what are your thoughts on that?
I used to be the same. I used to be very, you know, people come in on, you know, taking a vitamin supplement when there was no need to. And I said, well, you know, it could do this. And I was always a bit against it. And then when I started looking at the actual doses of pyridoxine you needed, I became a bit more relaxed about it. And then I sort of, I have to say, there are some people I think really do need to take a supplement. And it, particularly people who are going to starting out on a strict vegan diet. I think even if it's unregulated, if you're going and you're taking a strict vegan diet with absolutely no dairy product, I think you do have to go on a B vitamin. And in the UK, there is something called the Vegan Society, and they actually make their own vitamin supplement. Which I have to say I support, really, because I've had quite a few patients who've started a vegan diet without any supplements, and so 6-7 months in, they've developed quite a significant B12 neuropathy.
Yeah, so I think it's food for thought when people bring that up. Obviously, you know, if they're on a supplement, you'd have to correlate to their clinical symptoms, it seems like, and then decide if you feel strongly enough to tell them, well, maybe you should hold off on that.
Yeah, I try to just advise, you know, a balanced diet mostly.
Well, what would you say are some major take-home points for other physicians like me? You know, I'm not a neuromuscular specialist, but I do see this often in my clinic. So what are the key things that you would highlight for the general neurologist on the call today?
So I think the main one is someone's got a neuropathy measure of B12, but measuring the total B12 on its own, you will miss a lot of B12 deficiency. So, you know, if it's a mean normal value, if it's below the mean normal value, you really should be doing a downstream test of methylmalonic acid or homocysteine. That's one take-home message. Folate deficiency probably doesn't cause a neuropathy on its own. I think then with B6, if somebody's alcoholic, you've got to think about B6. Then the other one, which I haven't talked about so much, is the thiamine. But you can also get a very acute onset, severe motor neuropathy that looks like Guillain-Barré syndrome. And so my other take-home message would be, if you've got somebody, you know, you've got somebody with Guillain-Barré, they're malnourished or an alcoholic, or anybody with Guillain-Barré, have a low threshold for treating with Pabrenex. Okay, now it may be straightforward. You know, they've got very obvious demyelinating nerve conduction or conduction block. But I think an acute neuropathy, especially some element of nutrition, I would treat with intravenous vitamins. The other The other one is if you think it's nutritional, and it may, you know, sometimes somebody, you might be seeing them 6 months down the line and they had a very restrictive diet, they went vegan for a while, and then they've changed the diet back, but they've got a neuropathy and you've sort of missed the boat, really. So you do all your tests and they're now normal, and you're trying to work out what's gone on. I have to say, I find a team up with my ophthalmology colleagues quite a lot. And so sometimes, even if people aren't reporting visual symptoms, if you think it's nutritional, I may ask for an ophthalmology opinion, because you do get, you know, particular visual field defects or for subclinical optic neuropathy, which I think the combination of essential neuropathy and optic neuropathy does push you down a nutritional pathway. So, if you're trying to just work out when it's happened 6 months ago and you find they've got the two of them, then that does provide, you know, a reasonable amount of support. And the final one is you can get inflammatory nerve biopsies and CSF with nutritional neuropathies. Obviously, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be giving patients steroids and cyclophosphamide for, you know, vasculitic neuropathy. But on the other hand, if you see somebody and you are pretty sure it's nutritional and you do a nerve biopsy and you see vasculopathy with inflammatory cell infiltrates, you can see that. And that's been reported in the Cuban epidemic. They nerve biopsies from there, they reported perivascular cell infiltrates, CSF proteins of 1.5 grams. So just it's just out there. Obviously, it's not the commonest cause, but don't let that put you off if you think something is nutritional.
Yeah, that's great. That's a lot of great take-home points for people. As you were kind of going through your list of stuff for us to consider, I realized that I wanted to ask you about EMG studies, because how often do you get EMG studies on these patients? You're a neuromuscular expert, so is that something that you would commonly recommend to people? You know, someone comes in with a peripheral neuropathy, do you need an EMG study, and what would warrant that?
I do. I'm afraid. You know, if I see somebody and they've got sensory symptoms and I think it's peripheral, I do get nerve conduction studies on all of them. I just think it's helpful to know, you know, just on a, from a neuropathy angle, if, you know, if something is axonal or there's slow conduction, it just helps so much in the differential and risk stratifying patients to see which are the ones you need to necessarily follow up and which ones you can discharge. I also think it's helpful sometimes when you think somebody's they're peripheral, but, you know, the things don't completely fit, you know, the anchorders are just present. Yeah, because sometimes the nerve conduction can be normal, and then it makes you think about, you know, myelopathic causes of their sensory symptoms, which may also be nutritional. So I have to say, I'm in the setting where I've got great neurophysiology colleagues and you know, good access, I do request on everybody. But I appreciate there are other settings where you have to be more restrictive on who you request or undertake these studies on. I think it's fair to say, I think, you know, if you've got a sensory painful neuropathy in somebody with clear nutritional deficiency, then you probably need stronger grounds making a clinical diagnosis. Whereas when there's significant motor involvement, I think that's when it becomes more important to get electrodiagnostics.
Yeah, thank you for that. You've brought a lot of insights to my own clinical practice that I hope to take away from this. In particular, you know, I think one thing that I may try to incorporate more is asking patients about visual concerns, because I really didn't actually think about them having concurrent optic neuropathies before. So that's something that I'm going to try to, you know, implement in my clinical practice.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Why do some people, you know, some people with nutritional deficiency, some will present with an optic neuropathy, you know. So, I mean, they're, you know, you speak to the ophthalmologist, you know, they've got large cohorts. And then there's another cohort that present, you know, with sensory symptoms. And there's an even smaller cohort that I suspect exists that presents with hearing loss. But that seems to be the more uncommon one. And you, in my experience, I've seen people with optic neuropathy then get sensory neuropathy. And then they might have the hearing loss. But that triad of three.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you so much for today. I really appreciate your time and being able to get on the podcast with me and meeting you virtually. This has been fabulous.
Well, thank you very much for the invite, and good luck next week.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I did love your article, so I really hope our listeners can check it out.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. If so, please consider leaving us a rating or review on the JNNP podcast page. You can find a link to this in the description of this episode. If you missed it, check out our last podcast on distinguishing functional from primary tics, a study of expert video assessments. That's all we have for today. See you next time.